It is great to be here. It is great to see you. It would have been great to see you 3 weeks ago, but, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Tonight is not a preview. Tonight is a review. Our plan was that every month would be a preview, but snow didn't let us do that. When you come to March 3, that's looking into the things you'll read during March. Clear? Everybody okay? All right. There was some confusion the first month. I was working out of one chronological Bible. You guys are reading out of another. So I skipped Job because it wasn't in mine, and you guys have been slogging through there. Good for you. I want to take a few minutes and work through Job, if you will allow me to do that. You have seen Job, so this is not a preview. This is a review, so I'll remind you. The first little bit is really interesting. But as you try to ponder what Job was intended to do and how it was intended to convey its message, I would invite you to think of Job as a drama. Think of Job as theater. Think of Job as a presentation. This does not say anything about whether Job is factual or not factual. Job is factual, but the presentation is dramatic. And if you see it as a drama, then you perhaps see the opening is a glimpse of heaven, and then you see the consequences on earth. Where Satan asks for permission, he said to Jesus said to one of the disciples, "Satan has asked to sift you like wheat, but I'm praying for you." You get a glimpse in heaven, and that's what happened. Job was put into partial power of Satan, and Satan did some terrible things to him. As the time goes through, you see him in absolute misery. He loses his children, he loses his wealth, he loses his health. And at the end of this, it's like he's sitting there almost ready to die. But two things happen that are interesting. His wife comes to him and says, "Why don't you just curse God and die?" And he says extremely important things. Do you remember? You've read it now, so this is a review, not a preview. He said, "We take good things from God's hand, must we not take bad things as well?" And it says, in all of this, Job did not sin. Then three friends came. And the first thing they did is the absolute best thing that anybody could do under those circumstances. The three friends sat with him in silence as they looked at the misery he was in. There are times when such horrible things happen that the only thing you can give is your presence. Any words you try to say are going to make it worse, not better. You remember how long they sat with him in silence? 7 days and 7 nights. And then they started talking and ruined it. Now, I don't want to be overly critical of these guys, because remember, there's a dramatic presentation here. Some things that have happened have been packaged in a form where they have some truth to teach us. This is the way human beings react if they don't understand who God is and what God is doing. Their message came basically to say this: horrible things have happened to you. Horrible things don't happen to you unless you've done something that displeased God. You must have done something that displeased God. You better repent. It came from three of his friends. If you look carefully, maybe you've had a chance to do this, you may note some clues that some commentators believe indicate one of the friends was an older person, one was middle-aged, and one was young. There's some clues in the text to show you this, which means that you're getting one picture of what someone with lots of experience might say, who still doesn't understand all of God, what God is doing. And what somebody who in the middle of life, where lots of things are pressing on you and you've got deadlines to meet and all this, well, there's a sort of practicality to this. This is the guy who says, "Just repent, get it over with so you can get things going again." Because that's what they do. And then the younger fellow seems to have some vision of the rightness of things and a sense that doesn't see some other things. But in the words that they use, they're actually bringing more pain to Job, and they're revealing that there's a lot about God they don't understand. That takes 28 chapters. Because there's three or four cycles. One speaks, Job speaks. Second one speaks, Job speaks. Third one speaks, Job speaks, and they start again. And if you slogged your way through those cycles, you've seen some interesting things. You just may not have noticed them. So, let me work on a few of these. Actually, let me do something else first. If you go to chapter 28, Job gets a final speech. Job gets a final speech. We're going to go back and look at a couple of things before here. But he gets a final speech. Chapter 28 is one of the most amazing chapters in the Bible because he speaks about wisdom. He talks about how people dig in the earth for silver and gold and how people search the lands that they've never seen before trying to find new treasure. And he says, wisdom is something like that, except people don't seem to even know how to search for it. Chapter 29 is his apologia. That means his defense. If you've ever heard of someone, a few of you may know Ravi Zachariah, who's a person who talks about the Lord on radio and sometimes on other places. This guy calls himself a Christian apologist. That doesn't mean he's saying he's sorry for Christianity. It says he's giving a defense of the gospel to those who might criticize it. You hear that? So chapter 29 is Job's defense, his apologia. Chapter 30 is his description of where he is. And then the apologia begins again in chapter 31. Now, what I want to bring your attention to is 32, chapter 32. Because if you look in here, the drama starts to take on really interesting proportions. And it's a little hard to see, but there's a fellow who steps out of the crowd. His name is Elihu. He hasn't been mentioned. Chapter 32 is the first time you see him. But his stepping out of the crowd tells you that there's actually, in this drama that's set, there are people who are witnessing this. That fits what we know of the ancient world. Jesus went to dinner with a Pharisee, and here's all these people around him. And one of these was a woman who wasn't of good report, who her tears began to fall at his feet. Why was she there? Because people are allowed to come and listen to things like this. So Elihu steps out of the crowd, and he starts to criticize everybody inside. And he criticizes them, he says, because they haven't understood what God's trying to do. Now, what I want to do is I want to take you to what's happening in the background as Elihu is speaking. Let me see if I can find this. Chapter 35, verse 5. Elihu is speaking. He says, "Take a look at the skies and see. Observe how high the clouds are above you." And you go along a little bit. And in chapter 36, verse 27, "It is God who makes the raindrops small. He pulverizes the rain into mist." Verse 28, "The clouds pour this out, sending it streaming down on the human race. By this means he sustains the people." Verse 29, "Who can fathom how he spreads the clouds or why such crashes thunder from his tent?" You got a picture of what's happening in those series of verses? It's been clear. And all of a sudden, some clouds show up way up high. And then a mist or a fog shows up. And it gets thicker. And it starts to rain. And then it starts to thunder. What's happening? A storm is coming up. And it's coming up even as Elihu is speaking. Did you see those clues as Elihu was speaking? Did you see that? Let's go a little further. Verse 21 of chapter 37. "There are times when the light vanishes behind the darkening clouds." I think that's happening as part of the drama. Back in 37, verse 3, "His lightning is hurled across the heaven. It strikes to the extremities of earth. After it comes a roaring sound. God thunders with his majestic voice." The storm that the earth has almost never seen breaks. And then you come to chapter 38, verse 1. The first 9 or 10 words. "And from the heart of the tempest, God gave Job his answer." God speaks out of the worst storm that any of those people have ever seen. And what is the answer? Chapter 38, verse 1. God gives Job his answer. Job's got all these questions. Job's got all these questions. God gives him his answer. What does the answer consist of? 64 questions. God answers Job, listen to this, he answers Job with a series of 64 questions. And what are his questions? His questions basically are, why are you questioning me when there's fundamental things about how this world was built and operates that you don't have any clue about? And he takes him through chapter 38, chapter 39, chapter 40, question after question after question. Listen again, what is God's answer to Job? It's 64 questions to which Job has no answer. You come to chapter 42, and the first verse says, and this is the answer that Job gave God. After all the questions. Now, can I just stop there for a second? Would you permit me to do that? Because you've also slogged, I think, through Exodus, right? You remember when the Ten Commandments were given by God? How did God give the Ten Commandments to the people? Most everybody has the wrong answer to this. You got the wrong answer to this? Let's see. How did God give them?
Maybe you went up on the mountain.
And? Wrote them on stone tablets, right? Nope. Nope. He spoke. And it's in Exodus 20. He spoke. And when he had finished speaking, it only takes about 20 verses. The people's response is to Moses, don't ever let him speak again. If we hear God speak, we will die. You go talk to him. You come back and tell us what he said. We'll do it. Moses goes up on the mountain with him, and God writes it down on stone tablets. God spoke. And when God speaks, it's like nothing you've ever heard before. Here's Job's answer. I know that you are all powerful. What you conceive, you can perform. I was the one who misrepresented your intentions with my ignorant words. You've told me about great works that I cannot understand, about marvels which are beyond me, of which I know nothing. Look at verse 4. Do you have a parenthesis around the words in verse 4? Do you know what that is? That's the echo of God's voice from chapter 40 and chapter 41. That's the echo of his voice. God has been saying from chapter 38 to 39, look, listen please and let me speak. I'm going to ask the questions. You're going to inform me. That was God beginning his 64 questions way back in chapter 38 and chapter 39. God's voice is still echoing even as Job is speaking. And look at what he says. Verse 5. Before this, I knew you only by hearsay. Job is speaking to God. Before this, I knew you only by hearsay. But now, having seen you with my own eyes, I repent what I have said. And I repent in dust and ashes. Did Job get his questions answered? Did Job get his questions answered? Not the ones he had asked. Turned out to get a different set of questions answered that he never knew he had. It's a guy named Calvin Miller. He was quoted by Ravi Zacharias. While the snow was going on, I ran across this. Listen to this quote. The sermon and the spirit will always work in combination to produce liberation and freedom. Sometimes the Spirit and the sermon do supply direct answers to human need, but most often they answer indirectly. The sermon, no matter how sincere, cannot solve these unsolvable problems. Rather, together with the Spirit, the sermon exists to point out that having answers is not essential to living. What is essential is the sense, the certainty of God's presence during dark times of questioning. Our need for specific answers is dissolved in the greater issue of the Lordship of Jesus Christ over all our questions, those that have answers and those that don't. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. However, back in Job, there are a couple of other things I need you to see. Now, I'm going to tell you where it is. I'm not going to take time to read it. If you want to write this down, you can write this down. In chapter 6, verse 8, and chapter 6, verse 24, Job is speaking, and he asks the first of three very important questions. The question he asks can I know anything for sure? Isn't it possible for me to know something for sure? You go over to chapter 7, verse 17, you hear an echo of this. You hear an echo in Psalm 8:4. You hear an echo in Psalm 144:3. All of this, isn't there any certainty that we can have? Our world cries out for that answer to that question. In chapter 9, verse 33 and 34, an even more pointed thing, He says, I feel like I'm fighting God and I can't win. He's too big. Isn't there someone who can arbitrate between us? Someone who can be my arbitrator, my advocate. And then in chapter 14, verse 7 through 10, verse 13 to 14, he asks the question that many people ask, can a man live again after death? Is there life on the other side of death? If you go to Job 19, this is what I will go to. You read one of the most powerful verses in the Old Testament. I want to start at verse 23. Job 19, verse 23. Job is speaking. Will no one let my words be recorded, inscribed on some monument with an iron chisel and an engraving tool, cut into the rock forever? A couple of years ago, Barbara and I had a chance to be in Italy. We went into Rome. We saw the big arch that had been built 2,000 years ago, and you could still see the words carved into that rock. Will no one let my words be recorded, inscribed on some monument with iron chisel and engraving tool, cut into the rock forever? What are the words he wants inscribed? Here they are, verse 25. I know. What was his first question? Isn't there something I can know for sure? How does he start? I know. What do I know? I know I have a living defender. Isn't there someone who will be an arbiter between me and God? I have a living defender. And at the last, he will rise up on the dust of the earth. And after my awakening, he will set me close to him. And from my flesh, after death, from my flesh, I will see God. The one I see will take my part. My eyes will not be looking on a stranger. Almost immediately after that's over, it descends back into some other things that Job is talking about. But there's that moment. What does he say? There is something I can know, and I can know it for sure. What can I know? I do have a defender, and I will live after death, and I will be with him. That's one of the most great, one of the most wonderful affirmations you will ever hear of what the Christian belief is based on. Jesus is our elder brother, and he is going to set us close to him when life here is over. This is a beginning for what life in eternity will be like. Had you spotted that one? Just checking. Now, there's one more little thing. Job says a few times, I want to get a couple of places here that I can tell you. Chapter 4, verse 17, one of his friends says, can a mortal seem upright to God? Would anyone seem pure in the presence of his Maker? If you go to Job 6, verse 24, Job says, put me right, he's speaking to God, and I'll say no more. Show me where I have been at fault. Look at chapter 10, verse 7. Chapter 10, verse 7, Job is speaking to God. You know very well that I am innocent. Chapter 16, verse 17, Job is speaking. My hands are free of violence and my prayer is pure. Can you say you don't have any sin? Can you say that you are innocent and pure? Job does. Can you? The answer is yes. That's what Jesus does. If he takes our sin away, as far as the east is from the west, our sin is removed from us, what are we allowed to say? We are allowed to say we are without sin. That is not arrogance. That's faith in what Jesus said. And Job teaches us that. One of the earliest books in the Bible. I understand it's hard to make that claim because I know myself and you know yourself. But it's not my righteousness I claim. I claim Jesus because he gave it to me. Over in the New Testament, you'll get there someday. They're going to tell you about a banquet that a king had set. And he invited all these people, the hoity-toity, and none of them came. They all made ridiculous excuses. I bought an ox and now I got to go look at it and see if it's what I want to buy. And the king gets upset and he says, go out in the highways, just have people come in. Compel them to come in, wherever they are. And then all the guests are gathered. And he looks at one of them and he says, "Why don't you have a robe on, friend?" And that guy gets thrown out. The people come in, they're filthy, they're dirty, because they've just been out in the woods, they're homeless and all this. But what happened? They put a robe on. And all of a sudden, that's God's righteousness coming on. Somebody wants to come in but doesn't want to put on God's righteousness, that's not going to work. Now, that's the New Testament. That's a long time away. But there's a piece of that here. He said every time he was bringing his... Remember early on, he brought his family together and then he would have sacrifices just to make sure if there's any sin out there, we're going to settle it, get it clear. Once that's done, I'm right with God. And I can say so, and he does. And God essentially says he's right about that. Something bigger and grander is going on, and it's beyond your understanding for me to explain it to you. What's important? The sense, the certainty of God's presence during times of question. God's lordship over all our questions, those that have answers and those that don't. I like that quote. That's all you get on Job. Does that help a little bit? Exodus, we've already discussed the call of Moses, right? Right? The snake, the staff. Okay. Pick it up by the tail. You haven't been here very long. You don't pick up a hissing snake by the tail. You pick it up. Remember this? Okay. So that's where we're going to pick it up. Moses comes into Egypt. Moses comes into Egypt and he confronts Pharaoh. And what I want you to do is I want you to just look with me for a little while. I'm starting at Exodus chapter 7, verse 13. Exodus chapter 7, verse 13. Moses has come in, he threw his staff down, it became a snake. Some of Pharaoh's magicians threw their staffs down and they became snakes. Moses' snake ate up their snakes and then turned back into a staff. And it says in verse 13, Pharaoh, however, this is my translation, remained obstinate. Most translations don't say it that way. They say instead, Pharaoh hardened his heart. Does yours have that?
Yeah. Stubborn.
Okay. Pharaoh hardened his heart. That's the translation I'd like you to have. There's three or four translations out there. I've given you one here, obstinate. Yours is stubborn. But that phrase, Pharaoh hardened his heart. If you jump over to verse 22, Pharaoh hardened his heart. Mine says obstinate again there. If you jump over to chapter 8, verse 15, Pharaoh hardened his heart. And there's probably two or three more places where that happens. 8:19, he does it again. 8:32. Pharaoh hardened his heart. Do you see that pattern? Okay. Do you see something different in chapter 9, verse 12? Do you see something different in chapter 9, verse 12?
The Lord hardened
his heart. Folks, that is a gigantic, huge, huge shift. You persist in going against what God says. Time's finally going to come where God says, okay. Okay. And all of a sudden, it's real hard to get back. I don't like that. I wish that weren't true. I wish that weren't true. But it says if you're persistent at going against what God is doing, in spite of clear knowledge, he's got Moses in front of him trying to help him see, then eventually God says, okay, I'll help you. You want to harden your heart? I'll help you. And the rest of that chapter, the Lord made Pharaoh's heart hardened. He hardened Pharaoh's heart. It says it over and over, all the way through chapter 10 into chapter 11. Yeah.
And in chapter 4, verse 21, when the Lord is saying to Moses, telling him to go back to Egypt, it says there, but I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Mm-hmm. So how did it go from that to then Pharaoh hardened his heart to now God is...
It started out that Pharaoh hardened it, and God, I think that's a prophecy back in chapter 4. God's telling Moses what's going to happen so that Moses is not all that surprised.
Okay.
Now, when the firstborn died, Passover came. Many of you know about that. I'm going to leave that a little bit less. The 10th plague came, and they were finally allowed to leave. As they left, chapter 13, verse 21, the Lord preceded them by day in a pillar of cloud to show them the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light so that they could march by day and by night. The pillar of cloud never left its place ahead of the people during the day, nor the pillar of fire during the night. Do you remember Abraham back in Genesis? That covenant with Abraham. The animals are dead, split in half, half over here, half over there. Abraham is in a trance up against a tree, and there's a pillar of fire and a pillar of smoke that goes in between the animals. God is making that covenant. Same symbol. Same symbol. Okay? Now, chapter 14, the people have fled. Pharaoh has a change of heart. Pharaoh comes after them with his army. Pharaoh comes after him with his army. It's very important that you look in chapter 14 and notice the three reactions to this. The people, verse 12 of chapter 14, chapter 11 maybe. Was it for lack of graves in Egypt, they said to Moses, that you led us out here to die in the desert? They've seen the army coming. They're trapped against the sea. There's no place for them to run. Didn't we tell you as much in Egypt? What was the point of bringing us out? Verse 12, leave us alone, we said. We'd rather work for the Egyptians. We prefer to work for the Egyptians rather than die in the desert. Right after that, this is now verse 13, is Moses' response. What does he say? He says, don't be afraid. Listen, stand firm. What do the people say? Go back. What does Moses say? Stand firm. What does God say? Verse 15, march on. Three reactions. The people said, let's go back. Moses said, take a stand here. God said, uh-uh, march on. March on. What's out there? That's the Red Sea. And the moment they put their feet in the Red Sea, following God's orders, Red Sea splits. They move across. They walk across on dry land. It's not even muddy. It says they walk across on dry land. And as soon as they all get across, the infirm and the lame, the little kids, all the stuff they have, all the wagons and all that, the army comes in behind them, the sea closes, and the threat from Egypt is gone for a generation. Because the army and Pharaoh are all dead now. Little boy went home from Sunday school one day, sitting around the lunch table. Mother looks at him and says, what'd you learn in Sunday school today? And he said, oh, it was wonderful. Moses led the children of Israel out of Egypt. And they came and they crossed the Red Sea. He had the engineers come up. They built a pontoon bridge. All the people went across. As soon as they came across, the Egyptian army tried to cross. They had the engineers blow up the bridge, killed them all. Silence for a moment. The mother looks and says, is that what they taught you in Sunday school? The little boy hangs his head. And he said, no. But if I told you what they said, you wouldn't believe it. I like that story. I like that story. I like that story. But listen to that little front end. The people see the threat. Let's capitulate. Let's go back. Moses sees the threat. Moses sees the threat. And he says, stand firm. And God says, it's time to get going. Into places where it doesn't look like anybody could go. There's probably a sermon in that. I think I heard 3 points. I'm not allowed to have three. I have to have 31. Okay. Chapter 16. People complain. They're hungry. God sends them something. He sends them quail. Okay, I can understand quail. He also sends them this other stuff. I am told that if you translate the Hebrew word manna, it comes out, what's this stuff? I think that's true. That's what I'm told anyway. He says later, you ate manna in the wilderness for the whole of the wandering. And it was stuff you've never seen before, and you've never seen it since. And the name of it was, what's this stuff? Well, chapter 16 is interesting, but chapter 17 is more interesting. Chapter 17, they're hungry, but now they're thirsty. 17:1, the whole community of Israelites left the desert of Sin. I love the name of that desert. Traveling by stages as the Lord ordered. They pitched camp at a certain place. If you don't know how to pronounce something, just say a certain place and everybody will sort of give you a break. Where there was no water for the people to drink. The people took issue with Moses. That's my translation. They griped. They complained. For there was no water. They said to Moses, give us water to drink. And Moses replied, why take issue with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test? But tormented by thirst, the people complained to Moses. Moses appealed to the Lord for help. Verse 4, how am I supposed to deal with this people? And the Lord says, take the elders with you, walk over to that rock, and strike it with your staff. He strikes the rock, and the water comes. He strikes the rock, and the water comes. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 1 Corinthians chapter 10. I'm going to find it so that I'll read it the way it is instead of trying to get close. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. I want you to be quite certain, brothers, that our ancestors all had the cloud over them. That's the pillar. And they all passed through the sea. In the cloud and the sea, they were all baptized into Moses. They all ate the same spiritual food. What's that? That's the manna. And they all drank the same spiritual drink. What was that? Water from the rock. Since they drank from the spiritual rock which followed them, and that rock was Jesus. I don't understand that. But somehow, the provision of water is a sign of Jesus. Now, I want to leap ahead. This is a review, right? You've gone to the end of Exodus. You've gone a little bit further. Okay? Don't think you're quite there yet because you're not to Deuteronomy. But by the time this story is over in Deuteronomy, Moses has been told you're not going to be allowed to go into the promised land because you disobeyed me. You know when Moses disobeyed him? Moses went to this same rock and he struck it again. And that was what cost him his chance to go into the promised land. How many times is Jesus supposed to be crucified? Once. Strike the rock and water comes. Jesus said, I've got living water to give you. He said to the woman at the well, if you just knew the water I had to give you, you'd ask me for water. You wouldn't be just listening to me ask you. You'd be asking me. And I'd give you water and that water would never dry up. It would well up inside of you. Living water. Strike the rock, water will come. There are images from the Old Testament that I don't understand exactly what the facts of that are. But the meaning of that is there's living water Jesus gives us. And here they were getting physical water. And there's a parallel between the two. You get to the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, that's a long time from now. That's probably November. When you get to Hebrews in the New Testament, you're going to be reading, all these things happened for those people so that we would take a lesson from that. And one of those lessons is, physical things happened there that had spiritual meaning. I'm going to try to draw another one out before we're through tonight. Physical things happened that had spiritual meaning. This is one of the big ones. Because God said that second time, speak to the rock and water will come. And Moses struck it. And God said, that's a violation I can't ignore. It's going to look strange when you get there and read that. Actually, that was a little bit of a preview. Exodus 19. Exodus 19 is the great covenant. Chapter 20, verse 1, God spoke all these words. That's God speaking the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are there. Okay. Now, we've talked about covenants already, right? The covenant of Noah was a covenant of security. Covenant of Abraham was a covenant of name and identity and place, right? This is the Moses covenant, the covenant we associate with Moses. It wasn't a covenant with Moses, it was a covenant of God's people. But we identify it with Moses. This particular covenant has to do with boundaries. Life is meant to be lived within the boundaries. Been to an athletic contest lately? Been watching some of the Olympics? What happened when Brody Miller went off course? He's disqualified. Life is meant to be lived within the boundaries. The laws that you're reading about, the laws that are just going to seem like they're interminable, that's setting the boundaries. Okay? I'm going to try my best to help you understand this. So I'm going to say a little bit more than I planned to do because I'm realizing there's a couple of things I need to say. But life is supposed to be lived within the boundaries. What's the symbol of this? The symbol of this, interestingly enough, is not circumcision. We all think that, those of us who think about this. The symbol is keeping the Sabbath. You look over in Exodus 31, verse 12, you'll see that. It's keeping the Sabbath. Very interesting. It's not something you can do once that is the sign of the covenant. It's something you have to do every week. It's something you have to do every week. The sign of the covenant is not a one and done. It's actions that go. And most of all, it's obedience. In John 14, Jesus says to his people, his brothers, his disciples, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. If you love me, you'll obey. What do most of us say? Lord, I love you. I'm trying to obey, but I'm not doing all that well. What does Jesus say? If you love me, you'll obey. The sign of the covenant was obedience. Obedience. In the Ten Commandments, four of those are about God, including the Sabbath laws. Six are about other people, starting with parents. How to live in community. And starting there is the first collection of laws. At the tail end of this section in chapter 20, verse 18, seeing the thunder pealing, the lightning flashing, the trumpet blasting, and the mountain smoking. Thunder pealing, lightning flashing, trumpet blasting, mountain smoking. The people were all terrified. And they said to Moses, don't let him speak again. You go find out what he wants us to do. Come back and tell us, we'll do it. Okay? What was the first thing God said? What was the first commandment in the Ten Commandments? No gods before me. Right? Remember what number two was? Don't make any idols. Before Moses came back down off the mountain, Moses goes up on the mountain to do what the people ask him to do, to meet with God. Before he comes back down, what have the people done? They made themselves an idol and they started to worship it. When Moses comes down off the mountain, with what in his hand? The stone tablets that God, he's first spoken it, now he's written it out. And he's so upset, he throws them down, they all smash into pieces. You remember what Aaron said? It was his brother, the guy who becomes the high priest. You remember what his brother said? He said, I collected all this gold, I threw it into the fire, and look what came out. Go back and read it if you don't believe that. I think you have read it, right? Yeah. I threw this into the fire, and look what came out. A golden calf. Way later, we've had kings in the land of Israel. David, Saul, David, Solomon. And then the kingdom splits. The northern kingdom. You know what they start worshiping in the northern kingdom instead of God? Golden calves, just like they did back here. Watch for that. That's coming. Right there is the point. And most people miss it. Are we supposed to keep the Ten Commandments? Yes. Are we going to do it? No. Romans tells us nobody has ever done that, save Jesus. So what's the point of the Ten Commandments? To make it crystal clear, nobody can earn God's favor. Nobody can earn God's well done. God's favor and God's well done comes to people who don't deserve it, but who accept it. And the whole point of the Ten Commandments is, within just a few days, they had already violated most of these. The Ten Commandments are to hold up in front of us a mirror that we can't ignore, that says, you're not going to make it on your own merit. And it prepares us for what comes in the New Testament. There's sections on how to worship. There's sections on how to build the tabernacle. Late in Hebrews it says, Moses saw on the mountain the reality. And he came back down the mountain and he built physical models of it. There was in the tabernacle a holy of holies. There is in heaven a holy of holies. Down on earth, the blood of the sacrifices. There was a lot of blood in here, wasn't there? The blood of the sacrifices is taken into the holy of holies. Why? To try to cover man's sin. But it doesn't ever work for very long. And you got to go back with more blood. The real tabernacle, the real holy of holies in heaven, Jesus entered once, Hebrews says, once and for all, with his own blood, not the blood of bulls. When you read in here, did you notice how the sacrifices are supposed to be done? When the high priest offers sacrifices, what's the first thing he does? He offers sacrifices for his own sin. Then for his family. Then for his clan. Then for the whole of the people. Jesus didn't need to do that. He's not the same as the high priest. His sacrifice is different. But those sacrifices were to get us ready. Something has to die for sin to be overcome. And what had to die eventually was the Son of God. Exodus 25, chapter 10. Chapter 25, verse 40. Just this little verse. God is speaking to Moses, and he says to him, see that you work to the design which was shown to you on the mountain. That's what the people in Hebrews were using. Okay, chapter 25, verse 17. You will make a mercy seat of pure gold. Tells him how to make it. Verse 21, you will put the mercy seat on top of the Ark of the Covenant. That's the covering for the Ark of the Covenant. And inside the Ark, you will put the testimony, which I'm about to give you. There I will come to meet you from above the mercy seat, from between the two winged creatures which are on the Ark of the Testimony. There I will give you all my orders for the Israelites. That's my gift to you for next week. Because when we start in Numbers, that's the verse we need to know about. What does he say? I'm giving you directions on how to worship. I'm giving you directions on how to prepare. And when you have done those things, the place I will meet you is in the Holy of Holies, above the mercy seat. And we're going to talk about that when we get to Numbers. Chapter 35 to 40 talks about the tabernacle, talks about the vestments that the priests wear. Chapter 40, verse 34, God indwells the tabernacle and the journey begins. In Leviticus, there are rules and regulations and procedures for the Levites. That's why it's called Leviticus. Okay? Now, I said the journey begins, right? How long does the journey last? Some of you know. How long did they wander in the wilderness?
40 years.
But there's something that happens about 2 years in. And we're not ready to talk about that yet. We haven't come to that yet. So we're going to stop for a moment, and you're going to see some more of the laws. This is in Leviticus, details of the things. The Levites were one of the tribes. They're one of the tribes of Israel, and they are set apart to lead worship. The priests are from the Levite clan. The ones who are priests are the descendants of Aaron, Moses' brother. The ones who are not from Aaron's line, they are the ones who serve in some way. Maybe they serve as janitors. Maybe they serve as singers. Maybe they serve as ones who do other kinds of functions. But the Levites are ones who lead in worship. So much of Leviticus is talking about the Levites. So if you take a look in here, I want to take you to a few places. Chapter 4 in Leviticus. Right? The journey is still pending. The journey is ready to start after the indwelling of the tabernacle in Exodus 40. Chapter 4. Chapter 4 begins in verse 1 and 2 with what happens when someone who sins is an anointed priest. Do you see that in verse 3, I think it is? If the one who sins is an anointed priest, and then it tells you for a few verses what you have to do for that sin. Chapter 4, verse 13. If the whole community of Israel has sinned inadvertently, that is, they didn't mean to, but they did something wrong. Verse 22. When a leader has sinned and inadvertently incurred guilt by doing something forbidden. And the verses there talk first, what do you do when a priest has sinned? What do you do when the whole community has sinned? What do you do when a leader has sinned? Verse 27. What if somebody out in the country sins? Chapter 5, verse 1. If someone sins in any of these cases, they begin to have case law here. So this is for people to know what to do. That phrase, verse 15 of chapter 5, if someone is unfaithful and sins inadvertently by infringing the Lord's sacred rights, and begins to talk about things like that. They talk about cereal offerings. They talk about sacrifices for sin. All that goes along. I want to take you to chapter 8. Because at the end of all this thing about sacrifices and when you sacrifice and what you sacrifice for, the sins of these people, here's what you do, sins of these. Chapter 8, there is what my translation identifies as the investiture of the priests. They are now ready for the priests to begin to function. Right? And they have a service of dedicating them, investing them in their office. Investiture, that's what it means. Okay? Now here's what I want you to take a look. They're sacrificing some animals. There's some more blood here. Verse 22, he then had the other ram brought forward, the ram for the investiture sacrifice. Aaron and his sons laid their hands on its head. Moses slaughtered it, took some of its blood, and what did he do with it? This is chapter 8 of Leviticus, verse 23. He put it on the lobe of Aaron's right ear. Got it? Keep reading. He made his sons come forward, put some of the blood on the lobes of their right ears. They're going to be the next priests in line. on the thumbs of their right hands and on the big toes of their right feet. Let's look again. Where does the blood go? This is for the dedication. This is for the investiture of the priests, the ones who are going to lead in worship. Blood from the sacrifice goes where? Lobe of the big thumb of the right hand. Big toe, not the pinky toe. The big toe of the right foot. Everybody see it? Who was that for? Priests. Let me just check. Who was that for? Priests. Blood on the lobe of the right ear, thumb of the right hand, big toe. Right? Okay. And after that, they all begin their work. But if you go a little bit further, something interesting happens starting in chapter 11. You haven't forgotten priests, lobe, thumb, big toe, right? You haven't forgotten that yet. Chapter 11, it starts to say, here's what you do about things that are unclean. Did you see that? Chapter 11, chapter 12, chapter 13, all these unclean things. All these unclean things. Chapter 13, human skin diseases. Does yours have a different translation on chapter 13? What does it call it?
Contagious
skin diseases. Uh-huh. And it goes on and it goes on and it goes on and it goes on. Verse 45 of chapter 13. Chapter 13 goes on for a while. Verse 45. Anyone with a contagious skin disease will wear torn clothing and disordered hair and will cover the upper lip and shout, unclean, unclean. Oh-ho! A few of us who know something about the New Testament, what's this? This is leprosy. This is leprosy. Pause for a second. What do we know about leprosy? It's contagious. It's deadly. It cannot be cured. So they got rules that says if you see it, you got to isolate people. You got to quarantine people. You got to get them away because otherwise it's going to affect everybody. Got it? Pause. Let's go back over where we were before. These things happened to them so that we could learn a lesson. Physical things happening so that we can draw spiritual lessons. You remember that principle? You haven't lost that principle, have you? Okay, stay with me. Chapter 14, verse 2. Lord spoke to Moses, verse 2. Pause a minute. Leprosy cannot be cured, right? Chapter 14. This is the law to be applied on the day of the purification of someone who has suffered from a contagious skin disease. Such a person will be taken to the priest. The priest will go outside the camp. If he finds on examination that the person has recovered from the disease, nobody can be cured from leprosy. But if a person is, here's what you do. You like that? Did you spot that when you read it? Okay. He's going to take a live bird. He's going to slaughter them in earthenware pots over running water. Sprinkle the person to be purified of the skin disease 7 times. And having declared the person clean, he will set the live bird free to fly off into the countryside. Let's not miss this. He's got 2 birds. He kills one. The other's left alive. One is dead and one is set free. There's an image, a symbolism there. Okay? We're not going to do anything with it right this second, but 3 chapters from now we will. We just need the image as we walk by. Still with me? On the 8th day, this purification goes on over 8 days. That's verse 10. He'll take 2 lambs, an unblemished ewe, 1 year old, and he will do all these things, right? I want to come down here to the oil, right? Verse 15. Sorry, verse 14, he's going to take some of the blood of the sacrifice. Some of the blood of the sacrifice. This is verse 14 of chapter 14. He's going to do something with it. What does he do with it? Very interesting. He puts some on the lobe of the right ear, some on the thumb of the right hand, some on the big toe, not the pinky toe, big toe of the right foot. Does that sound like anything we just read? What does that sound like? That sounds like what you do when you get a priest ready to start working. But that's not all. He's then going to take the log of oil, pour a little into the hollow of his left hand. Verse 16, dip his finger the finger of his right hand into the oil and hollow, sprinkle the oil with his finger 7 times before the Lord. Verse 17, he will then take some of the oil left in the hollow of his hand and put it on lobe of the right ear, thumb of the right hand, big toe, not the pinky toe, right foot. Who's this for? These are for the people who've been clean. Unclean. Unclean. And what do they get? They get everything the priest got and then some. Blood here, oil here, blood here. What does this mean? There's a guy named Philip Rosenblum. Rosenblum. He wrote a book 2 decades ago, maybe. Somebody saw it, liked it, gave me a copy. I bought 2 copies so I'd have an extra one to lend. And I gave the 3rd copy, the one they gave me, the one I lend. I put a 3rd copy in the church library. Don't y'all run down there at once, but it's down there. It's called How to Enjoy the Boring Parts of the Bible. You know what he says about this? In the Old Testament, there is something that cannot be cleansed, cannot be cured, and it's leprosy. But there is a process for welcoming the recovered leper back into the community. What's the parallel of the New Testament? There is sin. And sin cannot be cured. But sometimes Jesus acts. And sometimes we respond to his action. And what happens? A sinner who cannot be helped, who cannot be healed, is healed. There ought to be a ceremony to bring him back into the community. Leprosy in the Old Testament is the physical. Sin in the New Testament is the spiritual. And there's a lesson here, folks. What do you do with somebody who has been a chief sinner and is outcast from the community, and he finds the Lord and he comes back in? What should we do? Put him to work. Doing what? Doing the work of a priest. And what is it that you consecrate? You consecrate his ear or her ear. What does that mean? May the Lord bless what you hear. May the Lord bless what you hear. What's that hand do? That's the work I do. What's the toe? That's on my foot. That's where I go. What I hear, what I do, where I go. May God bless all of that. I think Leviticus is powerful. Do you? I think Leviticus is powerful. You remember those two birds? Remember those two birds? Chapter 16. This is Yom Kippur for the Hebrews, for the Jewish people. The great day of expiation. On this great day, once a year, they bring 2 goats and they sacrifice one. And the priest puts his hands on the other, symbolically transferring the sins of the people to this goat. And they send the goat out into the wilderness. One dead, one out into the wilderness. And in that process, expiate the sins. Physical lesson for a spiritual meaning. When Jesus died, where was he? He was outside the camp. That was outside the walls of Jerusalem. In Hebrews it says at one point, let's leave the world. Let's join him outside the camp where he is. The great day of atonement. Verse 20 of chapter 16. Once expiation for the sanctuary, the tent of the meeting, and the altar is complete, the priest will bring the goat which is still alive. Aaron will then lay both his hands on its head and over it confess all the guilt of the Israelites, all their acts of rebellion, all their sins. Having thus laid them on the goat's head, he will send it out into the desert under the charge of a man waiting, and the goat will bear all their guilt away into a desolate place. In the Old New Testament, it says what had to happen once a year back then, Jesus did once and for all. Once and for all. Physical meaning, spiritual significance. Physical picture, spiritual meaning. Now, I want to get you ready for Deuteronomy. When we get into March, you're going to be in Numbers and Deuteronomy and a little bit in Joshua. Leviticus 26. It's almost like you're starting Deuteronomy. Almost the whole of the book of Deuteronomy, God is speaking through Moses to the people and saying to them, you have a choice to make. You can choose blessing and you can choose curse from me based on your actions, based on what you do. Chapter 26, verse 3. If you live according to my laws, if you keep my commandments and put them into practice, I'll give you the rain you need at the right time. The soil will yield its produce, the trees of the countryside their fruit. You will thresh until vintage time and gather grapes until sowing time. You'll eat your fill of bread and live secure in your land. I'll give you peace in your land. You'll go to sleep with no one to frighten you, and I'll rid the land of beasts of prey. Morning paper has the story of a new embassy the United States is getting ready to build in London. And we're having to build it so that it's safe from terrorist attack. U.S. Embassy in London, you can't sleep in peace inside that place. It's too dangerous. We don't live in a safe world. I'll give you peace in the land. You'll go to sleep with no one to frighten you. I'll rid the land of beasts of prey. The sword will not pass through your land. You'll pursue your enemies and they will fall before your sword. I will turn toward you. I'll make you fertile. I'll make your numbers grow. I'll uphold my covenant with you. I will live among you, verse 12 says. I will be your God and you will be my people. Verse 14 starts with an awesome, powerful word. What's the word? But. However. But. If you will not listen to me and do not put these commandments into practice, if you reject my laws, detest my covenants, customs, break my covenant by not putting all my commandments into place, this is how I will treat you. And here comes the curse. In the book of Deuteronomy, there must be a dozen, maybe two dozen times when this is laid out. And the echoes persist into Joshua. Joshua says at one point, this is three books from now, Joshua says at one point, choose this day whom you will serve. Choose this day whom you will serve. Our God or the gods on the other side of the river, that means the Egyptian God. Choose this day whom you serve. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. People have to make a choice. And the book of Deuteronomy is filled with trying to help people make that choice correctly. That's all I got time for. Can we have a word of prayer before we go?
Yes.
Father, we thank you for time and we thank you for this time. We thank you for the word you have given us and we thank you that you speak through it to each one of us in ways that each one of us needs to hear. I pray that you will keep us safe, that you will give us the ability to serve and work in the world that you've put us in, and that you will bring us back each time we come back to study your word some more. All this we pray in your Son. Amen.